Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by Get Set Go. Get comprehensive car insurance today at getsetgo.ie.
It's hard to say that this week belongs to anything other than Wicked, the sensational story that's gone from book to musical to movie, and it's back and set to be the biggest picture of the year. The origin tale of Oz has entranced the imaginations of all ages for over 30 years. It comes from the mind of one man, the author of Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, the novel first published in 1995. Gregory Maguire is that man. He's on the line. Good morning, Gregory.
How do you do, Oliver? Very nice to meet you, and I'm delighted to be on this show.
Oh, fantastic. And you sound in really sprightly form, so I'm very, well, I'm very pleased to meet you.
It's the morning over here, so I'm feel peppy.
You're very good. I want to speak to you about your own life and also about this original book. But can I ask, first of all, whether you've seen the second installment of the movie that everyone is just explosively talking about?
I have indeed. I saw it about 2 weeks ago at a private preview in New York City, and I will be at Lincoln Center with my family to admire the stars that turn out and to swan myself on the red carpet for a minute or two and see it for a second time.
Well, you deserve more moments on the red carpet. You enjoy that aspect because some authors, they don't often even show up to some of the movie premieres of their work.
No, I'll correct you, Oliver. I don't enjoy it, but I am a good performer. I'm a good Catholic schoolboy. If the nuns say, you go out there and look like you're having fun, then by God, I will. So that's what I do.
Those nuns are still echoing in your head even now.
Well, you know, they're the first people I ever met who wore long black skirts and had all the power in the world. So.
Okay. Yeah. You've met the cast and become friends with some of them, I understand.
Yes, I have. Ari and Cynthia and Johnny Bailey are all, I wouldn't say they're tight with me, but the affection is real, and they're cherished like close cousins when I run into them.
And you're texting each other. Who are you texting these days?
Well, I primarily text Cynthia, but Ari and I have shared a couple of hellos as well, and you know, it gives me a great deal of social capital in my household to say, oh, I had a text from Ari today.
That's from your three children, I presume.
Right, exactly.
Also, the fact you're calling her Ariana Grande to the rest of us, but you get to call her Ari.
Well, I'm sorry, isn't that pompous of me? But I made sure to do it.
Again, if you're on the red carpet like a swan, you can be pompous anytime you want, Gregory Maguire.
Well, absolutely. And I will go, that's as far as I will go since this is Ireland, about the kinds of relationships I've had with the cast members.
Oh, listen, Ireland's already taken credit for all the green, but we'll come to that now in a second.
Yes. You know, I lived in Dublin for a
while. Yes, exactly where I was coming next to.
Yeah.
This is Dublin. Was it the 1970s you're in Dublin?
It was the 1970s. It was about 74, I think. Yeah. The fall of 74, I lived in Harold's Cross and went to school in Ballsbridge called the School of Irish Studies, next to the RDS. I think the building now is I've been told it's a hotel. I haven't seen it again in decades. But
the school, but the RDS is still there. Even the fact you're referencing.
RDS is still there. And it was the next block on the same side of the street, the next block to the south towards Sandymount. Beautiful Victorian building in several colors of brick and stone.
You have a rich memory.
Well, you know, it was 6 months, you know, and I was lonely. It was my first time away from my high school bedroom, and I loved being in Ireland. I loved being away even more. And from Ireland, I was able to pop over for 10 weeks to travel on the continent and in England for the first time in my life. And all of that was really spectacular and started me off as a lifetime of travel and curiosity about other peoples.
And you said you went to school here. So, you know, were you sent over here? Did you decide to come yourself?
I was about 20 about, and I was a junior in college by our standard of measuring things. So I had 1.5 more years left of university education. Right. But since I had not been from the kind of family that could afford the room and board to send me away to a school or to a better school, I stayed close to home. I went to the local uni, and as a treat to myself, I said, well, I can't go away like a lot of my friends, but I will take myself to Europe for 6 months. That'll be my college experience. And in many ways, it was. The rest of my college memories have sort of fallen away like dust.
Really? This was your kind of rite of passage independence as an adult?
Oh, absolutely. I saw Rome, I saw Athens, I saw Paris, I saw London for the first time. I saw the Alps, I saw the Mediterranean, I saw Nîmes and oh gosh, Assisi, many, many places, Florence, that I wanted to see, all, you know, in the same 10 weeks. It was terrific.
Home for you is Albany, New York. Was that kind of rural Albany? What kind of area was that?
Albany is a city of about a little over 100,000.
I see.
It's the state capital of New York State, which for most of the 19th century and 20th century was quite prosperous. So it has some magnificent state buildings that give credit to the fact that New York State was known in the 19th century as the Empire State. Right. And Albany is beautiful enough that it really could be a capital city for many smaller countries. It's that beautiful. And I grew up in what was called a streetcar suburb. I know you have them in Dublin, where the houses are fairly close together. There wasn't much room for parking, but everybody left the house and walked down to the corner and got the streetcar to go into work in the city centre. And that was the kind of neighbourhood I grew up in.
Public transport was obviously better the last time you were in Dublin than it is now, but we'll go there.
Yeah, possibly. I did a lot of walking. Shanks Mare for me while I was in
Wow, all the phrases and everything. Catholicism was very much a force in your life growing up, and sadly you never got to know your mother.
That's true. My mother, my birth mother, died in childbirth, or died of complications from childbirth, about a week after I was born.
Wow.
So I was raised at first by an aunt, and then I was put in an orphanage for possibly a couple of years. I don't remember it, but I think I was there a while.
Wow.
And then my father, who had three other children besides me, all under the age of 9, got married again to my birth mother's best friend, a woman whose family was from North Ireland, from County Down.
Wow.
And she raised me very capably, lived 95 years. She was my mother. In fact, all 7 of us kids from my father called her our second mother. Even her own natural children called her the second mother, because the family had 2 mothers. And the first mother still counted, even to the kids who hadn't come from her loins.
So you had a very loving childhood, despite the traumatic circumstances at the beginning.
Very loving, very literate. Neither of my birth parents got beyond high school, and I'm not sure my mother even got out of high school because they were dirt poor during the Depression. My stepmother's family was even poorer, but they all had something fizzy going on up above the eyebrows, and they were sharp and moving, socially committed, literate, funny, very interested in etymology and in the proper use of language and grammar. And so I grew up in a household in which language was cherished second only, and just by a few centimeters, to the great glory of God. Language was almost an idol in our household.
Gosh. And these days, do you see the way, you know, your mother's early death, how it shaped your life? Because I've seen you talk about this sense of culpability that you may have been growing up with.
Yes, you know, it does help to be Irish Catholic if you really prefer to be guilty your whole life long. And so I was raised in the proper growing medium. I felt responsible for my mother's death and for the ways that she had been deprived from the lives of my father and my siblings, even though I was a fetus.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really have any decision-making authority.
No.
But nonetheless, it had happened because of me. And there was a kind of trade-off. I'm now talking about my 10-year-old moral mind, which is, you know, not terribly subtle, but it has a lot of power on how it corrects behavior. And my 10-year-old moral mind said, if I wouldn't be here without my mother, and my mother died to bring me here, then I suppose I really have to make sure that my life has been worth something. My life is worth it. I mean, it cost her life. And so at the risk of being overly sentimental, but believe me, I can go there, I just sort of had a kind of pact with myself that I had to live earnestly and intelligently and authoritatively and with conviction every day of my life in order to pay my mother back for her sacrifice. That actually helped me overcome the ordinary childhood fears and panics about not being good enough, mm-hmm. because it strengthened my backbone. I said, well, who cares whether I feel like I'm good enough or not? I have to do this. So I became a published writer, you know, by the time I was 25, in part because I wouldn't give up. And I needed to give something to the world. And I did not know that I would end up giving something to the world like Wicked.
That's something they're obsessed with in the billions at this stage.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a beautiful way to reckon with that whole start in life. It's extraordinary.
Well, you know, I talk about it as if I was abstract in my thinking. I wasn't. This was all intuitive and emotional. I was an emotional kid. But it was still basically it took the same ingredients and arrived at the same behavior. So whether it's abstract or instinctual, it nonetheless is a portrait of what I did and how and why.
Of all the places you could have escaped, maybe the Catholicism you had in your late teens into your 20s, Dublin does seem like the unlikely place to come. Since
exactly. I thought that I would be safe in Dublin, and indeed I was. Yeah. I know many people of my generation, especially in the last 20 years in the United States, have solidly and forcefully turned their back on their Catholic upbringing and their Catholic faith.
Yeah.
I have not, but I have known so many selfless people in the world who have given their whole lives to the betterment and the comfort of other people, their education, their health, their loneliness. And many of them are priests and nuns and have done nothing but good work. So I keep my membership card to the Catholic Church activated.
I think you're speaking for a lot of Irish people.
Yes, even if I'm not a frequent attender at Sunday Mass these days, but I'm going to be buried a Catholic, and I'm going to be buried in a Catholic cemetery. And to realize that now, even though I'm still quite healthy, I hope, is a consolation to me.
Okay.
I carried forward the faith that my parents gave me, and that was another job that I had to do. And I've tried to give it to my kids. Whether they've taken it or not, well, that's their business.
But
I've made the effort,
I must congratulate you, because September marked 30 years since the publication of the novel Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, to give it its full title. What was happening in your life, Gregory, as 1995 dawned?
Oh, my gosh. Oliver, I had just moved back to the Boston area in the United States after 5 years of living in central London. And I was what the British so fondly call financially embarrassed.
Which is just, I love that phrase.
I didn't have two tuppence to rub together, which was good because they weren't in circulation anymore. I was almost 40. No, I was 40, and I had written the book, and it had been accepted. I'd been paid rather handsomely for it, given what I'd been paid for books before that.
Yeah.
So I came back to the United States in 1995 thinking, this is either the end of my writing career or the beginning of it. It's not the middle. I mean, chronologically right now, it's about the middle, well, earlier than the middle. But at the time, I thought either this will go or it will crush me. And the first week, I thought it was going to crush me. And then the second week, I thought, oh, it's a go. I could tell. I mean, the book was published, let's say, on a Tuesday or mm-hmm. Wednesday. And it got a bad review in the New York Times on the Thursday, 2 days out. A stinker, Oliver, a terrible review. I actually, had to turn my eyes to the airport window so nobody could see that it was having its way with me. And then the following Sunday, and I thought, it's done. My career's over.
It's dead.
My agent is gonna fire me by the time this plane touches down in Milwaukee.
And Lord,
that's the end of my life. And that was Thursday. On Sunday, the book got a glowing front page, top of the fold review from the LA Times. And on Monday morning, my phone started ringing off the hook from Hollywood.
Unbelievable.
Of people who wanted to option my book. I heard from Claire Danes. I heard from Demi Moore. I heard from Whoopi Goldberg. I heard from any number of actresses who wanted to sew up the rights for this powerful vehicle. And the rest is history. So it was not the end of my career. It was really the beginning.
And it's interesting to hear that you were expecting it to be a film, a movie first, not a musical.
Yes, despite the fact that I love music and I have been a musician of sorts, I have performed and I have written music and I have conducted choirs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I did not see it as a musical. And when Stephen Schwartz, the composer of Wicked, the play and the movie, first got in touch with me to talk about whether I could liberate it from Universal for a straight movie and deliver them to Stephen Schwartz for a stage musical. If I could do that, he said he could build up the property to the point where when it finally got to be a movie, it would be unstoppable. And indeed, that's exactly what he did. But what I pointed out to him when we met, we talked about it. I said, you know, Stephen, it's true. I never thought about this being a musical, but there are three places in that 406-page book where Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West, sings. They are important places. The fact that she had a voice, a singing voice, within the pages of the book was part of my characterization of her. I thought, if somebody had given her a song in the 1939 film starring, you know, Judy Garland and all that lot, we would have felt differently about her, even if it was a song about how evil she was.
Yeah.
We would have heard more about who she was. And that was what was missing. So I gave her a song in the pages, but I didn't see, I'm quite honest, I didn't see that somebody would read that and say, oh, this should actually be happening on stage.
It's extraordinary just hearing the name Elphaba, which is a name known now everywhere. It's entirely a name you invented as a tribute to the original.
As a tribute to the writer Lyman Frank Baum, who published under L.F. Baum. And when I was looking for a name for the witch, because, of course, in order for her to be individualized, she had to have a real name, not just the witch. That's how we demonize people, by calling them the spook, the, you know, the this, the that, the other. You know them all.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want her just to be a witch. She had to have a name, but she could not have a pretty name. She had to have a name that was, you know, almost a little unpleasant.
Yeah.
And so I took L. Frank Baum's initials and I wrote them down on the edge of my notepad and I played around with them in different iterations. And then I got it by initializing the first one, but articulating, aspirating the second two letters. And there she was, Elphaba. Now she's Elphaba for all time.
Very satisfying.
You know who else made up a name? Was J.M. Barrie. I don't know if you know this, author of Peter Pan.
Yeah.
J.M. Barrie made up the name Wendy. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
It did not exist before Peter Pan Wendy. He made it up. And, of course, it's now a standard classical name and it's been so far 125 years, but he made it up. So I don't ever think there are going to be little Elphabas on the playground, but but you never know. There are a lot of Elphabas in the dog park, believe me.
J.M. Barrie, you're in very good company there. And the story, the original story, you have your own family. I don't know if your children are old enough to read the original novel, are they?
They are. My children are now in their mid-20s. Now, whether they choose to read the original novel, that's a question you have to take up with them after it's cleared by security. But they certainly could read it if they wanted. They do love the movie. They love the play. And they've grown up with the play. Once when my daughter was about 5, she was on the playground at school, and I was called in by the principal. And they said, we really need to ask you to ask your daughter Helen, age 5, to stop singing songs from the Wicked on the playground. And I said, well, I fully understand that Helen cannot carry a tune, so I know why it might be socially objectionable. But what else is this about? And they said, oh, well, we think poor little dear Helen doesn't realize that not every family has its own private family musical.
Oh, my God.
And I said, oh, you don't know Helen very well. She realizes that very well, which is why she's singing them.
I can just see her defying gravity every day. That's Dad's fault.
Tunelessly defying gravity.
That's amazing. Listen, your husband, Andy Newman, is an artist.
That's right.
And I don't know if I got the right Andy Newman online, because I've looked up an artist around America, and he oil paintings of beautiful homes around France and Lisbon and places like that.
And that is andynewman.net. You're quite right.
Extraordinary, beautiful, beautiful homes. You must spend a lot of time then in Europe.
We do. We actually have a home in France down near Avignon, and we have been going there for 20 years, although I have to admit that considering the political situation in our nation at the moment, I'm sticking pretty close to home just to keep an eye on everything. It just seems like the proper and judicious thing to do.
Why would you need to stay, do you think?
Well, to be frank, Oliver, Andy and I have our three children. They're all adopted from overseas, and they're not Caucasian. Mm-hmm. They from other places. And while Massachusetts, where we live primarily, is the most liberal or one of the most liberal places in the nation and is rather safe for people who look like immigrants, nonetheless, there's no place in the United States where people are not being halted on the sidewalk.
U.S. citizens included,
Or pulled out of cars. Even if it's just a 15-minute interruption of their day, it would be enormously alarming to one of my children should it happen. And I don't want to be overseas swanning around and having a good time while they are feeling anxious about this kind of thing.
How so incredible that you that this is in your head now at this stage in your life.
Oh, I know. It's appalling.
Your fear is.
It's appalling. And my children are older and competent. It's maddening. You don't need me to tell you how frustrating.
It's extraordinary because it's now got kind of Supreme Court mandate to profile people on the street like that.
I can't think of anything that's happened in the last 20 years of my life as a citizen that has been more shaming than what is happening in our nation at the moment. But I am determined to protect my children. I didn't adopt them just for 20 years. I adopted them for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And if they're more comfortable because I'm here at the other end of the phone with lawyers on speed dial, then this is where I'll be.
Well, I'm sorry that you're going through that, especially someone who gave us that theme of, you know, ostracizing people for being different, for being green in the novel Wicked.
Absolutely. And the play and the movie both make, you know, weather out of populations being sequestered and being taken away and being imprisoned. And I didn't invent this stuff. I just used it for a novel 30 years ago. And there are various people, Oliver, who went back to reread my novel when the first movie came out last year. And instead of calling it retro, have said, you know, McGuire's novel of 1995 was prophetic. He had a prophetic vision about what could happen here. Well, I didn't think it was prophetic at the time. I thought it was a little retro. It was more Stalinist and totalitarian in the 40s of Central Europe.
Because you're post-Cold War and all of that.
Yes, absolutely. But in fact, what goes around does come around, I'm afraid.
It does.
And as Ecclesiastes said, there is nothing new under the sun. Oppression is not new. It is constantly recurring. I hoped I wouldn't have to see it in my country ever in my lifetime, but here
well, we
are.
Remain hopeful on this side of the Atlantic for the great democracy of America. You're there,
I
too.
I think there's a lot of good reason to hope. And
thankfully, we have lovely distractions, like the film and like your work as well.
Well, thank you. We do have lovely distractions. And in fact, nothing lasts forever. And we will repair and we will carry on. And we have not forgotten our purpose toward ourselves and our purpose toward the rest of the world, even if evidence of it is not very clear to ourselves or the rest of the world at the moment. But we'll leave that behind. Have you plans to see the new movie?
Absolutely. I mean, it's all everyone is talking about at the moment. And I want to make sure, and I wish you well, because the next week is going to be fantastic for you and your family.
And oh, I think so.
You've been through everything, Gregory, haven't you, at this point in life?
Oh, well, yes, I have. And luckily, my health continues fine. And as far as I can tell, cognitive deterioration has not yet shown up on these shores.
Certainly not.
At least in me. I won't talk about any of it.
I've had such a great time in your company. Thank you so much, Gregory McGuire.
And Oliver, it's a real pleasure. You have a wonderful day and evening over there.
You too. Good luck to you, your husband and the family.
Thank you so much, Oliver. Bye now.
Thanks a million. Bye-bye.
Email oliver@rte.ie.